ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You can't control what you don't understand. I'm Ray Johnston, and in Opt Out, I'm taking back control of my digital life. Join me as I track down my data, lock down my accounts, and learn how to fight back. Opt Out, the Download This Show guide to getting off the internet. To hear it, search for Download This Show wherever you get your podcasts or hear it on the ABC Listen app.
Hi, this is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. It is summer on ABC Radio National, so I'm bringing you some of your favourite stories from the year gone by. And today we are talking housing. Yes, the structures we live in, like how to make sure they're the right size and fit for whatever stage of life you're in, and how making the move to downsize isn't always as straightforward as it seems. We'll also dig into the strain housing stress can put on relationships, namely the self-induced stress of a renovation. I also get to ask a professor of architecture the question on everyone's lips, which is why all the couples on home reno shows choose this stressful time to get pregnant. Australia's housing crisis is getting worse. New homes aren't being built fast enough. Supply is near its lowest in a decade. Earlier in the year, the National Housing Supply and Affordability Council reported 177,000 homes were built in 2024, falling short of the 223,000 expected. That makes the federal government's target of 1.2 million new homes in 4 years look unlikely. There are plenty of reasons for this shortfall. Soon, you'll hear from a housing expert on what needs to change. One promising fix is modular housing. This report says it could cut build times by 20 to 50%. New South Wales is already testing it, with factory-built social homes nearly finished. So, could modular homes be key to solving Australia's housing crisis? I'd love to hear from you on this. Are you trying to get into the housing market, build a home, or just hold on to your rental? What barriers have you hit? Could something like modular housing have made things easier for you? Brendan Coates is the Housing and Economic Security Program Director at the Grattan Institute and joins me now. Brendan, the National Housing Supply and Affordability Council report says we're falling short on housing supply. Why?
Well, there's three real reasons. It's probably never been a harder time to get more housing built in Australia than it has been in the last 3 years. Because interest rates have risen really sharply. So they've gone up, you know, 4 percentage points in the course of, you know, less than 18 months. They're now on their way down. But we know from Reserve Bank research that every 1 percentage point increase in interest rates basically means housing approvals are about 7% lower the following year. The second reason is because the cost of construction has gone up really sharply, you know, 30 plus percent over the course of the last 3 or 4 years. And that's made a lot of projects that would otherwise be feasible, but infeasible. And then there's issues around labour. So, you know, we've got a full employment economy. That's a great thing. Unemployment is, you know, hovering around 4%. But it's made it harder for the construction industry to find workers, particularly some of those skilled workers that are often otherwise being employed building these big infrastructure projects in states like Victoria, New South Wales and Queensland. You put those three things together and it's a really difficult picture for home building at the moment.
So how do new home builds numbers compare to the number of families on the public housing waiting list?
That's a great question. I don't have the numbers in front of me on the public housing waiting lists because it does run in the tens of thousands across particularly the bigger states. So we're in a world right now where social housing is, you know, obviously the thin end of the wedge. If you're trying to get on the social housing waiting list, it's because you're struggling to afford housing and you're a vulnerable or otherwise low-income earner. But just more broadly, we've seen the fact that rents and house prices have risen sharply across Australia in the last few years, particularly since the pandemic. That means many more Australians are struggling to pay to keep a roof over their head than what they were, say, 5 years ago.
So you visited a site outside Melbourne where modular housing is being built. It's a sort of prefabricated or blocks of houses that can kind of be put together a bit like Lego. What does that look like?
Well, it's a pretty impressive process. So this is very common in places like Sweden where most housing is built in a prefabricated setting, in a factory and then installed on site. and Australia is a real laggard here, where, you know, estimates are that somewhere between 5 and 10% of housing in Australia is prefabricated to some degree. Obviously, that's a spectrum, right? Because, you know, if you buy a set of windows and they've been made in a factory in China, that is still technically a form of prefabrication. It's not all being put on site. The challenge, though, is that we just don't have that scale in Australia. So I did a visit to Modscape, which is a prefabricated housing factory in Essendon Fields in Melbourne. And it's impressive. You see robots putting together a house frame or an apartment frame within about 3 hours. You know, a house takes 2 weeks just from start to finish to be built.
That's crazy.
But obviously that's a lot of capital that's had to be invested in the factory to get it up and running, and it's not necessarily cheaper at the moment.
So I'd like to bring in my other guest who's looking at modular housing in a new way and saying that it could be at least part of the solution to bring costs and build times down. Professor Matthew Aitchison is the Chief Executive Officer of Building 4.0 Cooperative Research Centre, which is at Melbourne University. He's currently working with Home New South Wales. Matthew, what you're doing is a bit different to the modular housing that Brendan was just talking about. Walk me through what you're involved with.
Thanks. It is a little different than what Brendan was just talking about in the example of, say, Modscape. I guess you'd say the conventional wisdom in the prefabrication, industrialised building, off-site construction industry, it's got many names, in case you couldn't guess, has been to do as much as you can off-site, minimising the amount of hours on-site to increase the speed and use the factory process as much as possible. As Brendan just intimated, that can be very costly. You have to set up that factory, you have to run that factory, and in some cases you're competing with an on-site industry that really has no overheads and is extremely flexible. So what we're attempting with our partners at Homes New South Wales and the New South Wales government is to try to find a midway solution, if you like, where we split the building up into products, much like you would a flat-packed piece of furniture from IKEA. Those products can be made by a network of suppliers, and those products come together on site and fit together like an IKEA product on site.
If it's happening off site, is it really that much quicker then, or are we just not seeing that prefab part of the process?
Our contention is it's definitely much quicker. I think one of the issues with the business model of what I'm going to call today conventional prefab is that everything is done in the one factory, or most things are done in the one factory. And as I said before, we're trying to ship as much of that finished product to site. Really, the hypothesis we're working on in New South Wales is that we would like to have as many manufacturers as possible out there in industry making as many of these parts as possible. And that doesn't have to be in the same factory, right? So we are getting the manufacturing uplift, the productivity uplift from doing things in a controlled setting, like in a factory. But we're also acknowledging that there'll always be a part of building that needs to be adjusted and be flexible for what needs to be done on site. Let's say around 20% of the building work will still be done on site, and those parts, if you like, will be fitted together using the 20% of that glue, if you like.
You're listening to Life Matters here on Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor, talking about whether partly prefabricated or modular homes could be part of the housing supply question and what it could mean here in Australia. Darcy from Bell in New South Wales says, my wife and I just finished building a modular or prefab home in the Blue Mountains. It was built in a factory in Gosford and brought up via truck in two pieces. It took 5 weeks to build a 100 square metre home in the factory and a few days to install on site. The biggest hurdle for first home builders is seeking finance for such builds. Banks struggle to lend money like they do for conventional builds. Also, John in Newport's texted in saying, it's the planning system. I've just spent over $60,000 getting a development approval for a single house. So, Brendan, how can the back end of the finance system and the housing development system keep up if it's not just about the build times being long, it's also all these other processes that can slow people down?
That's right, Tegan. So the existing systems of finance, of planning approvals, of building approvals, you know, have been developed around the idea of what Matthew's calling, say, traditional construction, stick builds, where all that construction occurs on site. There are stages through which, the things are checked off by building surveyors or regulators, and the same with the finance as well. Whereas, that we need probably different systems if we're going to be able to efficiently deploy, modular or prefab or industrialized construction. There are a lot of names for what we're talking about here. If we're going to deploy them at scale in a way that is efficient and effective for the industry and for the end consumer. And I'd probably defer a bit to Matthew, who knows the regulatory regime more strongly than I do, but certainly there are things we need to do to make that system more efficient than it is today.
I do want to come to you, Matthew, with the caveat that we don't have much time left. What needs to change and what kind of timeline are you on with the project you're working on?
Well, just quickly, the timeline, the project's been running now 1 year. We're coming up to a major showcase, which will occur in September, and we expect the program to continue for another 2 years. Look, what needs to change? I think this is where the State of the Housing System for 2025 report gets it right. It needs to be a holistic solution. So you've mentioned regulations, your listener mentioned banking. There's been a lot of work on the skills and training aspects. All of these things have to proceed in step. What I would probably draw attention to is something that's been appearing in all of the reports lately as it concerns housing, and that's around productivity. We're not going to get to higher productivity in housing and construction more generally if we don't pursue innovative processes. So whether it's conventional modular, whether it's what we're attempting to do in New South Wales by splitting up the building into different parts, I welcome every and any innovation project that can be done at the moment, because we're not good at it. The Productivity Commission report from February this year shows exactly how bad construction is at innovation. And I think in the short term, we need to pull all levers and try all things. And in the longer term, we really need to address why innovation has been so bad in the construction industry.
Thank you both so much for your insights. Professor Matthew Aitchison, the Chief Executive Officer of Building 4.0 Cooperative Research Centre with Melbourne University, and Brendan Coates, the Housing and Economic Security Program Director at the Grattan Institute. And thank you for your texts. Damien says, after getting more than 20 quotes from builders and building companies, I went with a factory-built home in northern New South Wales. It was made of three pieces, delivered and installed in 1 day. Well, up next on our housing special on Life Matters, now that you've built your dream home, maybe your mind is turning towards a renovation. But what could that mean for your relationship? Have you ever renovated a home? If so, you'll know that renos and relationships can be a fraught combination. But with property costs rising, buying a fixer-upper to work on sometimes feels like the only real option for homeowners. A staggering $12.8 billion worth of renovations were given the green light across Australia last financial year. And I am guessing a total of around $12.8 billion fights between couples might also accompany that dollar figure. So if you and your beloved are planning a renovation together, how do you make sure it doesn't lead to issues in your relationship? Have you embarked on a renovation project? What impact did it have on your relationship? Maybe it brought you closer together. Maybe it really tested you. I'd love to hear your reno relationship story. And if you're obsessed with home reno shows, then you'll know Restoration Australia host Professor Anthony Burke, who is no stranger to renovators biting off projects bigger than they can chew. Also joining me is clinical psychologist and director of the Brisbane Centre for Attachment and Relationships, Claire Rosamond. Anthony, I will start with you. What are the first things you should consider if you're beginning a restoration project?
I think the more you can do up front, the more discussions one can have before a shovel meets the ground is probably the best advice I could give. You know, we all know the roller coaster that everyone's about to sort of jump on board with. And so the way that you establish what is important, what are the priorities, what are our values here, why are we even doing this? You know, those sort of big conversations need to be kind of really crystal clear at the beginning. And I think that's probably the first step. But we all know that this is a roller coaster, and it has a every renovation has a kind of a psychological cycle to it. You know, the enthusiasm, the ambition becomes a bit harder. You're going to sort of get it down in the dumps and then you finish. And that kind of sine curve, if you like, of emotions is a pretty predictable one.
Claire, tell me about this emotional roller coaster. What's happening in these ups and downs, like Anthony's saying?
Oh, well, I mean, a renovation is so stressful, such a time of stress and change. Like, I think that would test anyone. And so I imagine that these sorts of pressures on a couple are going to exacerbate any negative patterns of communication that might have been there before, or they might even create new ones. And so typically what we find in times of stress and change is our emotional signals change. Instead of being warm and fuzzy and clear with each other, in communicating in ways that pull the other in, we get more prickly, more spiky, or more shut down, or more critical or defensive, which of course then creates a different reaction in our partner and vice versa. So we can get caught in these patterns where the more we try to cope in the way that makes sense to us, the more it contributes to disconnection.
Anthony, when you started working on Restoration Australia, I'm sure you've come from a background of the architecture background and that sort of thing. Were you surprised at the emotional component of a show like this?
It's a great question. I sort of was anticipating it. I mean, everyone's home is their most emotional investment, right? So apart from each other. So this is an emotions first, rational second kind of space that we're in. But when I first started doing this too, I was thinking, oh, it's all about architecture. I'm a professor of architecture. I know a bit about that. It's all going to be about houses. But as my producer said to me at the time, she says, no, these are human stories and just don't forget that. And that has been the biggest surprise, I suppose. I mean, I kind of expected it, but it was much more powerful than I imagined. And it's been the biggest pleasure, you know? So now I really think of these as people stories, and architecture is the kind of the medium that helps tell the story.
Well, I am asking for your stories today. Tell me about how your renovation affected your relationship. Did it bring you closer together, or did it really test you? Anne in Newcastle has texted in saying, we're on the tail end of our renovation. We have children aged 5 and under. The reno took out our kitchen and living space for nearly 6 months. All the washing up was done in buckets with the hose in the front yard. Barbecue, toaster and coffee machine lived on the front porch. And Anne says, I have to say it was fine. We were pretty happy and ready to move back in when it's finished, but it worked well under the circumstances. She says, the things that made this work, my husband set up a really good space in the front room of the house that doubled as a kitchen and lounge room. Also, having a kids at an age where they don't understand personal space anyway is useful when there is no personal space. Anthony, how does that story gel with what you see in your work?
I love it. I love that Anne's had a kind of a relatively pleasant experience out of this. It's great. Absolutely gels. I think what's really nice about that is too, there's a sense behind those words that there's a little bit of an adventure going on here. The family realises it's not in, you know, normal space, normal territory. So it's a bit like, now I'm going to say this and I'm going to regret it, I know, but a bit like going on holidays for a little while where everything is different. Your routines are a bit different. You know, your daily sort of, discussions are all of this a little bit different. So if you embrace it like that, you can kind of enjoy it. I had a renovation at my place 2 years ago, and we had to kind of camp out in a little sort of studio space out the back in the backyard. Every night my wife and I would pull the bed out of the couch, and every morning we'd put it back again. And then everyone would sort of descend on the kitchen, and it was tiny. But you know, after sort of 12 months of that, we actually really enjoyed it. And because it felt like a space out of time in a way. And, you know, and we moved into the house and all's well. So I sympathise enormously with Anne, and I'm glad she's got a smile on her face.
And you sort of feel like you've earned it by the end of that process as well.
Oh, yeah, I think so. Yeah, no, the reward is huge. The payoff, of course, when you sort of step in is sort of like, okay, we've put in the hard yards and this is ours now. So, you know, it's not like just sort of buying something and sort of having it show up on the front door. This is something you've really worked for.
Well, Ted has called in. Ted, you took a big risk. You bought a house without telling your partner.
Yes, that was a little bit of a shock for her, but we got over the hump.
Tell me about the stress. Like, were you taking a big swing, or did you just sort of not think to tell her?
Well, it was so different to everything else we'd always had. I've renovated forever, but the opportunity came up to sort of make a change to our life, and I thought, well, I've seen it, I've got to do it. I can't live with myself if I can turn away from this opportunity. And perhaps she didn't feel quite the same when I finally did tell her that, oh, by the way, remember the house I was talking about and the block I was talking about? We own it now.
Ted, thanks so much for the call. Lisa, you've done 6 renovations. How have they impacted your marriage?
Well, we're not on criminal charges yet. So, you know, close to 40 years, we're probably more in love than we've ever been. And each renovation has been unique. We've lived in all of them whilst we've done them. They've been top-to-toe renovations. And one time with one of them, my husband said to me, I thought I was being really clear with this one, that we were communicating really well and we had a deadline and it was going to be 6 months from start to finish. And the morning I headed off to work, he said to me, right, you ready to go? And I said, yep, 6 months. And he said, yep. And I came back and my kitchen was gone. And for 18 months, I had a wok, a toaster, a kettle, and a very fancy hose up to the second floor that was my dishwasher.
Lisa, thanks so much for the call. Claire, I want to bring you in on this because what I'm hearing with both of those is communication perhaps gone wrong each time. Yeah. What are some of the traps for young players here?
I think your communication is everything, really. Like, what we know about secure couples, if they have a secure attachment bond, they can navigate life's challenges. They can bend and stretch flexibly. They can communicate clearly. They regulate their emotions better and their bond stays really healthy. And that's what I think we hear in these beautiful success stories, is that when people can navigate the stress of a reno well, they have all those beautiful ingredients there. But if the wires get crossed, communication gets jumbled up, messages get tangled and scrambled, then that's when people get into trouble. So I think the more you can be aware of how your signals, your wires get crossed, and maybe your intent in the message you're sending is different from the impact in how it actually lands with your partner, that's probably the secret weapon here, is getting more and more aware of those patterns and the way you signal so that you can work on changing your delivery. So that you can pull for the best from the other, really.
And just building on what Claire said before, Anthony, there's the way that we communicate with each other can sometimes have a mismatch, but also our levels of perfectionism can differ across a couple too.
Yeah, I think so. And look, normally one partner will take the lead, you know, like it doesn't matter, him or her, it doesn't matter, but they kind of, there's someone who believes that they are the expert and the kind of like the project manager or the designer, or that takes on a kind of a badge like that and runs the project for the couple in that way. And most of the time that's great because those roles are kind of agreed. And so you play a kind of support. One of the questions I generally ask the homeowners when I meet them for the first time is like, what are the roles you're playing? Who's doing the finances? Who's doing the project management? Who's the designer? So in that sense, once that's clear, then as Claire's saying, there's a kind of a clear sense of, all right, well, I'll be responsible for these things. You'll be responsible for those. And we'll talk about the space in the middle together. So I think that's a really important part of it all. One thing, though, I think that comes up, which is really interesting, that sort of comes back to what Lisa was saying, was, you know, when you say to two different people, even if they're in a relationship, what's your idea of this home? They're going to have two different pictures in their heads. And what I think happens a lot of the time is you get to a point when you've torn down you've torn out the kitchen, you've broken through some of the walls and you've started to make a real mess. And then the builder comes in and starts to actually put things back together again. And the first thing someone says, like, hang on a minute, why is that going there? I thought we were doing that over there. Or what? You're building a giant man shed out the back? I thought we were going to do the kitchen first. So the idea of the home, you know, in everyone's mind is a little bit different. And I think that's a conversation that's really a difficult one to have because it's quite abstract. impact when you're about to launch into this. So it's one thing to be right about the economics, the timeframes, their pragmatics and values you can could have put a number on. But those more abstract ideas of what is home to us, that's a conversation that people probably rarely have. And it's one that you kind of need to have, I think, before you go into any of this, because it helps you set those values and priorities.
Mm. Well, Greg from Long Beach is living this. Greg, you're renovating a house to make it suitable for getting older, and it's taught you about compromise in your marriage.
We're trying to get the house so that it's nice and level. We can live on one level and there's no steps. And there are various things that we were wanting to do. And we had this big bucket of money because we sold the place, our family home, and moved down to the coast. So we thought we had all this money. But, of course, you know, like everything, and we knew that costs were not going to be all that stable. So it's all this give and take. But knowing right at the start where you can compromise, I don't think we talk that through enough, because as we're getting further and further into the build, you're looking at ways of really trying to save money. And while we phased the approach and we did the big things first, as you get further and further into the build, there's things that you really have to sort of lower the quality that you actually wanted.
Yeah, that compromise becomes a bit harder as you get further in. Greg, thanks so much for the call. Anthony, budget is sort of one of those things that I don't think you're actually allowed to put out an episode of a renovation show without talking about going over budget.
That's right. There's a legal requirement now that, yeah, we must meet that particular bullet point.
What I mean, I was going to say why. Like, obviously, there's always a finite amount of money. Somehow it's always never enough. Have you ever witnessed a renovation project that came in on or under budget?
Well, actually, I have. They're about 20%, actually about 15% of our projects come in on budget. So, but I mean, then that sounds, well, that's a little bit of a sort of like a light on the horizon there. Oh, great. There is some hope for us all. But of course, that just means 85% of projects don't come in on budget. Even my own reno at home, where I was absolutely diligent about it all, you know, I still came in 8% over where I wanted to be. So, hey. But I think it's one of those things too, where there's a certain amount of expectation for the dollar. There's a naivety for many homeowners when they go into a renovation about the just the amount of work that has to be done. So you think, oh, we've got $500,000. That's a lot of money. We can do tons with that, can't we, sweetheart? And then the next thing you know, it's gone before you've even sort of started to put the walls up, because it's all gone into the foundations. So I think there's an expertise that has to sort of be a part of this. And when we're in renovation space, we tend to think we can do it all ourselves. And that's where I think that's when an architect or an engineer or a quantity surveyor, those sort of people who know the space, really add value. And you have that conversation up front rather than in the midst of it all. Because when you're in the midst of it all, of course, that's when it's all so much more intense. You're tired, you're stressed, you're trying to make decisions. I mean, every build has something like 10,000 to 40,000 decisions. You know, that's just for a simple renovation. So all that decision fatigue that you and your partner are going through, that is totally stressful. And then to try and sort of, within all of that, manage a kind of a budget sanely and make big decisions on the fly, that is like only adds sort of like insult to injury, I think. So if you can kind of bring that kind of conversation way up front, give yourself some clear parameters and then, you know, and then delegate the roles and be comfortable with that. That's the best advice I've got. And that's kind of what I see happening in those projects that are most successful. But saying it is one thing and doing it, it's a very different thing.
You're listening to Life Matters here on Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor, and we're talking about renovations and relationships today. A different Greg has called in. Greg, you and your wife had a long renovation project that took 18 years. How did that go?
Well, it went very well, actually, in the end. We're incredibly happy with the result. We basically bought the house in 2006 here in an industrial suburb of Newcastle, Mayfield, and we wanted to live in it. We worked with a friend of mine who was an architect and who was very keen on utilising what we had on site. It's a very modest place, but built in 1926, and effectively we were very keen to try and utilise as much as what we had here instead of bringing lots of things in. But of course, talking about a house built with hardwood, nothing square.
So come finally to the build, after we were very disciplined and what was supposed to be a modest renovation turned into a modest rebuild, then be turned into a major rebuild. And that is going back to, I guess, the point that Anthony was making and your other guests about the decision-making process, is that we remained very committed to our price, and that despite the bank wanting to offer us a hell of a lot of money, which was ridiculous, we said no and we remained. And in fact, we came in under budget.
Stop it.
And we,
bravo.
And we had... And both of us had worked in the media industry as well, and I'd produced television commercials and et cetera, and we always factored in our contingency of about 10 to 15%. And we had buffer.
That sounds great, Greg. Thanks so much for the call. Jasmine, your renovation deepened your relationship.
No, actually, it did the opposite. My husband did all the building himself, and he was an orthoptist. And we had a teenager and two young children. And rather than, tear us apart, I saw him in a different light, and I grew to respect him in ways that I, weren't available before the renovation. So it was actually really, really good. It was hard with two young children, but no, it had a very positive effect whilst we were renovating, yeah.
Wonderful. I'm just going to go straight to Jennifer, who also had a really positive renovation story.
Yeah, hi. Look, the reason I actually rang was Anthony's point on home really resonated with me. And I guess, we renoed 20 years ago for the third time. We're living in that home. My husband kind of added on to, rammed earth onto a steel new frame kind of little cottage that we bought, and it's still home. So, yeah, the definition of home isn't necessarily about what others think is valuable.
That's a really lovely insight, Jennifer. Mm. Thanks so much for the call. Anthony, do you want to speak to that a bit more?
I'm just going to agree with Jennifer 1,000%, that's all. I think she's really, again, back to that emotional connection, but yeah, that picture of what a home is to all of us is actually very different. Even though we kind of talk a lot about the Australian dream and how we've all bought into the idea of the Hills Hoist and all of that kind of stuff, actually the lived experience of home is so specific to each one of us. And when you go into a project and you're thinking, well, I just want to take all the best parts of home that I've experienced and sort of bring them out in the renovation, that, of course, is a sort of a beautiful plan, a beautiful aspiration for a project. But you're standing next to your partner who's had a very different life experience before they met you and all the rest of it, and they're having a slightly different version of that. And I do think then it's one of those things where if you can have those, it's almost like, look, one of the things that a really good architect will do is when you go to see them and say, well, like we'd like to do our renovation, they'll do a design for you. But the first design's not the one they want to build. The first one design is really a test to see if what you want is actually what you really need. And so there's a kind of like a psychology going on there. You kind of use the first design to flesh out the important parts of the design. So it's probably the third design that they do that is really going to be the one that really sort of finds you in the project. Yeah. And I think to Jennifer's point, that idea of home is very, very different for all of us.
Claire, is having something like that sense of home, like an emotional North Star, a useful way of navigating what we've discussed at length can be a really fraught experience?
Yeah, I think that's a really lovely focus to have. And the more clearly partners can communicate about that and flesh out a shared vision, then I imagine the better they would navigate the project. It's when they probably haven't really articulated that and don't have a shared vision, that there's a lot of room for miscommunication, misunderstanding, disappointment, hurt feelings, differences in energy and passion, and all of that would just amplify an already stressful situation.
Anthony, I do have to, it would be remiss of me to have this conversation without asking you a professional question. What is it with renovations and renovation shows and people falling pregnant?
I think I should handball that one to Claire.
It's so true, though, isn't it?
It is true. I mean, we've had it happen
yeah, at least won a series. It's slightly weird. I mean, why would you do that in the midst of one of the most stressful things you can do with your partner? You're going to add insults. I might add it, make it even harder by having a baby along the way. Maybe there's something just about like we're so in love with our future. We're building it, and a part of that future, you know, requires the addition of a little one to the family. Claire, help me.
Yeah, with the fleshing out of the dream, wanting to push the goals forward, I think you're on the money there. That's my best guess.
I think it's like living life on hard mode. Either way, Anthony, Claire, thank you so much for coming and sharing your insights today.
Pleasure, Tegan. Great to talk to you.
Anthony Burke is the host of Restoration Australia and a professor of architecture at the University of Technology, Sydney. Claire Rosamon isn't on TV, but we love her anyway. She is a clinical psychologist and director of the Brisbane Centre for Attachment and Relationships. And thank you for sharing your relationship reno tips. And look, if it all goes wrong, you can always just cash in and downsize. The pitfalls and positives of moving house to suit a new stage of life is up next. Well, earlier in the program, you heard about how building modular houses could take pressure off the housing crisis. But when it comes to existing stock, are you willing to sacrifice your house to downsize, to help others live the dream that you had? And if this is something you've looked at, you might have realized it's not as simple as just leaving your nice big family home. Downsizing might also mean leaving your friends, your GP, the neighborhood that you love, all things that are really important as we get older. And even though people sometimes think downsizing means cashing a big property check, that is not always the case. So how can we make it easier for Australians to downsize, and would it actually help the housing crisis? Tell me about your life. If you've downsized, what was it like? Or if you haven't, what's stopping you? With me is Lauren Jones, a buyer's agent in Brisbane who works with people looking to downsize. Dr. Michael Fotheringham, CEO of the Australian Housing and Urban Research Institute. And Estelle Holmes, who downsized from her four-bedroom house on Queensland's Gold Coast a few years ago. Estelle, I might start with you. Tell me what prompted your move.
Good morning, Tegan. Well, it was a couple of things, to be honest. The housing boom was in full flight. I didn't have any debt, but I was running short of funds, and I saw an opportunity. Also, I was not that enthusiastic about doing all the work that I was in a four-bedroom, two-bathroom house with a garden and so on. So I made the decision to downsize.
It sounds like a no-brainer, you know, cash in some money and that sort of thing, but it was a hard decision for you because it was full, your house was full of precious items and they weren't going to fit in a small home.
Absolutely. It was actually overwhelming. However, I did enlist the services of a downsizer or a right sizer. And that was absolutely life-changing because she came along and we, through lots of tears and my being overwhelmed with the process, she took me by the hand basically and walked me through the whole process. And she actually said at one stage, which made an enormous difference to me, Estelle, I am going to be always here with you. I will not leave you. We will see this through. And that actually was life-changing for me. I felt like I had a super cape on. I felt like I jumped the moon. And that's exactly what I did.
Well, with me, as I said before, is Lauren Jones, a buyer's agent in Brisbane, not a downsizing or right-sizing expert, but definitely someone who's involved in people making this move. Lauren, when you're talking to people who are looking at downsizing, what are they typically looking for?
I like to think that there's generally two different types of downsizers. So the first one, they tend to be about in their 50s, and that's once, you know, the kids have just moved out and they're just looking for that next home. Generally, this isn't their forever home. They're still very capable of things like stairs, swimming pools, a bit more garden maintenance. And then I find the second types of downsizers are those looking for their forever home. Oftentimes, you know, they're in the 60s, potentially the 70s. They tend to want low-set homes, low maintenance. They generally don't want pools, unless, of course, they want the kids to, or the grandkids to still be able to come over for a swim. And stairs really becomes a big issue as well. So I find, yeah, very different types of downsizers.
And are they able to find what they need, especially if you're living in an old suburb with mostly big homes?
I find, so that first age bracket, the 50s, I find yes, because they're generally still looking for houses. They've generally got the budget to be able to afford that same location that they've always grown up in. They've got, you know, the kids are still probably nearby. They've still got all their friends, GPs, things like you spoke before. I find yes. I find the older age bracket, you know, the 60s, 70s, that can be a little bit of a struggle. Oftentimes they're looking in very different locations. I find that 60s, 70s age bracket as well. A lot of the time the kids have moved away, whether that be interstate or down by the bay, and I find it's quite a big lifestyle change for them as well. It's a difficult process either way though, because buying and selling at the same time, especially when you're doing it simultaneously, it's very hard to buy another property with a subject to sale clause in it. I've seen properties, you know, the highest offer might be $50,000 more, but it's got a subject to sale clause in it, and the sellers of that property simply won't take that offer. So it can be very difficult. We're also in a bit of a housing crisis at the moment as well, so it's not as easy to just, you know, go and rent at least until you can purchase another property or build a home as well. A lot of downsizers at some point in time were building their dream home because it's going to be their forever home, but that's just not an option or doesn't seem like an option for a lot of people at the moment.
Heaps of logistical barriers there. You are listening to Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor, hearing from Lauren Jones, who's a buyer's agent in Brisbane. You've also been hearing from Estelle, who recently downsized. And I'm interested to know if you've downsized or you've looked into it. Just tell me what it has been like for you, what barriers you've come across along the way. One person says, we sold our 5-bedroom, 3-living area home and bought a townhouse in the same suburb. Cost was like for like, but now we have a better location, best decision we've made for many years. I was sick of living with the ghosts of my family all around me on the off chance that they would all be there at the same time and we would need the space. Greg from Ballina says, I've downsized from a 3-bedroom house to a 2-bedroom house with a granny flat at the back. Renting out the granny flat provides housing for another retiree and gives me a small income as I'm short on superannuation. Also with me is Dr. Michael Fotheringham from the Australian Housing and Urban Research Institute. Michael, as it just has turned out, we've got Lauren and Estelle both here from Southeast Queensland. What's the picture across Australia?
It's pretty similar to what we've been hearing. I mean, I think Estelle's story really captures a lot of the decision-making that's involved in this. It's often triggered by people wanting to reduce the amount of maintenance they need to do in what's an increasingly empty home. And looking for something a bit easier to maintain is often the first starting point. There's the financial dimension to it, and people often assume that by selling a family home and buying a smaller property, they'll end up with a lot of extra cash. But actually, because they're typically buying something newer and selling something that's been lived in for quite some time, it comes out as more or less neutral in terms of cost for most people. There's a really big emotional dimension to this too, letting go of the family home. That's hard for the people who are selling, but also for their adult kids who have attachment to the place they grew up. And then there's the reduction of stuff that you need to do. All the things that we accumulate is a real challenge.
I think it's hard if you're a younger person wanting to have a family or you have one and you're looking for somewhere bigger, looking at older generations who are rattling around in big old houses feels unfair. But if everyone who wanted to downsize could, would it actually make that much of a difference to housing supply?
Well, potentially, yes. I mean, if you think about, if we've got all these homes that are built for raising families, they're the larger homes, the 3- and 4-bedroom homes that are intended for families to grow up in. There's a backyard for the kids to run around in if they're not attached to their screens. All the sort of dimensions you think about of the family, traditional family home. If they're being occupied by one or two people who are, you know, largely shut the doors off for a lot of the bedrooms most of the time, that's not making best use of the assets we have. So, you know, from a system perspective, those people moving into dwellings that are more suited to their current needs and having other young families move into those homes makes a big difference. But it's not a simple thing to do.
Is there also a place here for planning changes so that there are perhaps more mixed use across suburbs than just suburbs that are full of big houses and not really somewhere that people could downsize to if they wanted to?
Yeah, this is one of the real challenges. We tend to build large areas of suburban homes, you know, traditional suburban homes, 3 and 4 bedroom homes, and don't have that mixture of dwelling type within each local area. And many people who are downsizing want to do so in their local area where they know the pharmacy, they know the GP, they've got their, you know, all their social ties to that place. You know, there are others that want a tree change or a sea change or want to move closer to the city, but many people want to do so in their local area. And if there's not available supply that suits their needs, then they're not going to make the move.
Estelle, what went into deciding where to live when you downsized?
I had a picture in my mind that I wanted to live by the bay. And I had really targeted Cleveland area. So I had a focus. And I started, before I sold my home, which didn't take very long to sell, by the way, it was only a matter of a few weeks, I had found an apartment and I could see the potential in it, and I had also been involved in doing some renovations previously in my lifetime, and I purchased an apartment that was size right for me, and I completely refurbished it for my needs, and I absolutely love it.
That's so lovely to hear, Estelle. Lauren, just listening to Estelle's story, it's reminding me that you've noticed a gender split in your clients. Tell me about what you see across genders.
Yeah, I find a lot of the time, so we work with a lot of women who oftentimes they've left a marriage and they come to us because they're looking for that next home. I find most of the time they're looking for either a townhouse or a unit. I think there's a few parts to that too. I think a lot of the times they're not prepared to do all the garden maintenance on their own. And I think safety becomes a real issue as well, especially if you've been in a relationship for majority of your life and then all of a sudden you're on your own. So, yeah, I find that split definitely tends to happen, whereas I find a lot of our downsizers, single males, they tend to still be quite keen on having a house. You know, they want a shed where they can tinker in. So I find the dwelling type of males versus females is very different.
This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor speaking to Lauren Jones, a buyer's agent in Brisbane, Dr. Michael Fotheringham from the Australian Housing and Urban Research Institute, and Estelle Holmes, who recently downsized, about downsizing. Lauren, a text says, saying, this lady is spot on. I think they're talking about you. We're in our 80s. It took 3 homes to get it right. We finished up building, but it was very hard to trade my piano for a keyboard. We went from 4 bedrooms in Melbourne to 2 bedrooms in Sale, no stairs, small garden. And a question for you, Michael. Greg says, with downsizing, a major disincentive is stamp duty on the smaller home. It reduces the funds left over, if any. It's often cheaper not to move until forced to by age. Is this something we need to reconsider?
Our stamp duty is definitely a barrier to mobility in our housing system right across the board, not just for downsizers, but for people, you know, who are looking to move location for employment or need a larger home as their family grows. You know, it certainly is a barrier to people moving around the system more, so is an inefficiency in our system. There is a better way to do it, you know, an annual land tax model where people don't pay stamp duty up front but pay an annual land tax is a better model. It's the transition to that that's the problem.
Is this a bit of a snake eating its own tail, Michael? I'm thinking about people who have older children, adults, who want to buy a house but they can't afford to, and perhaps if there was more larger houses available, then they would be able to buy a house but they can't, and mum and dad can't sell the house because their kids haven't moved out yet. Is it just a sort of a bit of a self-fulfilling thing?
Well, yeah, it is actually, yes. So you know, we have a largely stuck system, and you know, the Greg's point about stamp duty being a barrier is a big part of the problem. It's a big part of the lack of ability for people to move around from house to house to meet their needs, you know, whether it's around family size or their other, you know, work and education commitments. We should have a system that allows more mobility for people to move houses more often to meet their needs. But we are a bit locked into this system. And you know, it's widely recognised that this is a problematic tax system. The challenge is for state governments, it's a big source of revenue, and turning off that tap in favour of a more gradual annual land tax, which is a much smaller amount per household, is very difficult for state budgets to accommodate.
Lauren, you're not a policy person, but the sorts of anecdotes that you're hearing from the people that you're working with, are there things that you've gone, gosh, if we just change the system a bit, this would make a big difference?
I'm very much in agreeance on the annual land tax as opposed to the stamp duty, but I understand the issues around that. But I think that's such a big part of why people don't downsize, is because it is so expensive. I met with a lady just the other day, and she's looking to downsize from about a $2.5 million home to about a $2 million home. And in that process, it'll cost her about $150,000 to $200,000 just to downsize. So I'm seeing a lot of people like that, and I find in some instances it can actually be quite sad, because especially that kind of older generation, they essentially wait until the home becomes a hazard, and that's when they sell the home. Which, I mean, if there was that land tax instead of the stamp duty, they might move out before issues like that come about.
Michael, there's a new report into housing that says that there's a big mismatch between who lives in our homes and the kind of homes we're building. Talk to me about this mismatch.
Well, you know, these days, more than half of Australian households are one or two person households. You know, the average household size is just over two people per household, but more than half are one and two person households. But we continue to build freestanding houses much more than we build apartments or townhouses. And those are typically three and four bedroom houses. So you know, we're continuing to build for the large households we had 100 years ago, while in fact we need much smaller dwellings. And that leads to a real inefficiency in the way our cities operate. We're travelling larger distances as we use this sort of very low density form of housing in Australia. You know, at the moment, for every apartment that we build, not every apartment building, but for every individual apartment, we build six freestanding houses. And that's, you know, as our current new builds, doesn't reflect the changing shape of our households. So we need to sort of adapt to and rethink our approach to what does good housing look like.
There's so many texts coming through from you. Mary says, my parents downsized to an apartment by the river. Lovely for them. The hitch was I was renting the apartment next door. So at 30 years old, I found myself sharing a bedroom wall with my parents. Not so fun. Another person saying stamp duty is a real killer. One says, I've been toying with this idea for several years now and was misguidedly working on a changeover cost of around $40,000 to $60,000. I was corrected by someone in the know that it would be more like $100,000. There's an awful lot I could do with that $100,000 in hand. Lauren, what do people need to know about this to go in with their eyes open?
See, that's something I see a lot as well, is people say, you know, this is going to cost me $100,000. I may as well put that into the property and make it, you know, I could put a ramp in or something like that to make the home more functional. But the problem is that they don't actually have that $100,000 in cash. They only get access to that $100,000 when they sell the home. So,
yeah, it's really tricky. Michael?
Well, that's right. I mean, it's equity rather than cash in hand. So, yes, that's really challenging. And, yes, I think getting advice on the likely costs is a good first step.
Estelle, you've moved into an apartment. It sounds like it's been a really positive experience for you. Is there anything that you go, oh, this is what I'm telling all of my friends when I'm sitting down for coffee? What advice are you giving them?
If they are thinking about downsizing, I would truly recommend it. For me, it's been my first foray into community living, which does have its challenges sometimes. However, I am very fortunate where I live. It's been a very good change.
Well, it sounds like you really hit the jackpot, Estelle. Thank you so much for sharing your story this morning. And thanks as well to Lauren Jones, a buyer's agent in Brisbane who works with people looking to downsize, and Dr. Michael Fotheringham, CEO of the Australian Housing and Urban Research Institute. And I've loved your stories this morning. One text says, I gave birth to my daughter in my home, and she gave birth to her daughter here too. It is a home for generations, and frequently all beds are filled. I have friends who visit often. I can't see myself downsizing. I looked at it some time ago, and the apartment with the services that I wanted was twice the price of what I could get for my house. Another text says, our recent downsizing experience was great. We're both in our late 70s. We found our home was too large to cope with. We've been able to make a good downsizer contribution to our super while staying in our community. And earlier on in the program, you heard about the highs and lows that renovating can have on your relationships. So if you've got the tools out building your dream home this summer, heed these communication tips from Professor of Architecture and Restoration Australia host, Anthony Burke.
normally one partner will take the lead, you know, like it doesn't matter, him or her, it doesn't matter, but they kind of, there's someone who believes that they are the expert and the kind of like the project manager or the designer, or that takes on a kind of a badge like that and runs the project for the couple in that way. And most of the time that's great because those roles are kind of agreed. And so you play a kind of support. One of the questions I generally ask the homeowners when I meet them for the first time is like, what are the roles you're playing? Who's doing the finances? Who's doing the project management? Who's the designer? So in that sense, once that's clear, there's a kind of a clear sense of, all right, well, I'll be responsible for these things. You'll be responsible for those. And we'll talk about the space in the middle together. So I think that's a really important part of it all. One thing, though, I think that comes up was, you know, when you say to two different people, even if they're in a relationship, what's your idea of this home? They're going to have two different pictures in their heads. And what I think happens a lot of the time is you get to a point when you've torn down you've torn out the kitchen, you've broken through some of the walls and you've started to make a real mess. And then the builder comes in and starts to actually put things back together again. And the first thing someone says, like, hang on a minute, why is that going there? I thought we were doing that over there. Or what? You're building a giant man shed out the back? I thought we were going to do the kitchen first. So the idea of the home, you know, in everyone's mind is a little bit different. And I think that's a conversation that's really a difficult one to have because it's quite abstract when you're about to launch into this. So it's one thing to be right about the economics, the timeframes, their pragmatics and values you can could have put a number on. But those more abstract ideas of what is home to us, that's a conversation that people probably rarely have. And it's one that you kind of need to have, I think, before you go into any of this because it helps you set those values and priorities.
Well, that is Life Matters for today on ABC Radio National. If you are making your way through the holiday season gift shopping, you will want to catch tomorrow's episode, which is all about buying ethically, or whether that is even possible anymore. And you can catch up on any of the stories today on the ABC Listen app. I'll catch you tomorrow.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.